In the Limelight.
The head of a Norway-based NGO has been shocked after witnessing the catastrophic humanitarian conditions in Rafah in southern Gaza caused by the Zionist regime's months-long genocidal war on the besieged Palestinian territory. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, visiting a school sheltering some 4,500 displaced Palestinians who fled Gaza City in the north of the territory and nearby Khan Yunis, Jan Egeland, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, NRC, in a post published on X platform, recently expressed his dismay at the living conditions they were enduring. He said, the disabled, the pregnant, and the newborn share 18 latrines with 4,500 others. Malnutrition, epidemic disease, and trauma is everywhere. Egeland slammed the Zionist regime and its allies for carrying out a relentless onslaught against the besieged civilian population of Gaza and called it a stain on an international community which has failed to secure any kind of restraint or humanitarian access. He called the situation in Gaza in an interview with CNN recently, people are traumatized beyond belief and live under the most horrific condition. In an earlier post from the Rafah border crossing into Gaza, Egeland said hundreds of aid trucks were waiting to travel into the Palestinian territory to help a starving civilian population. He added, the system is broken, he said, of the process involved in allowing aid into Gaza, adding, Israel could fix it for the sake of the innocent. Recently, a United Nations official said that Israeli forces are systematically blocking access to people in need in Gaza, complicating the task of delivering aid to the besieged Palestinian territory. Rafah, the town along the Egyptian border, which was once deemed a safe zone by the Zionist regime military forces, has now become the last refuge for over half of Gaza's entire population of more than 2.3 million who have fled their homes in other parts of the territory to shelter from incessant Israeli regime attacks. At least 500,000 people are facing famine in Gaza, while the entire population of the territory is experiencing acute food shortage, according to figures from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. Over 30,000 Palestinians, including 14,000 children, have been killed in Gaza, 146 days into the latest offensive launched by the child killer regime of Israel, according to Gaza's health ministry. The Electronic Intifada also wrote, Ahmad Hanun and his extended family are now living on a poultry farm in Rafah. In southern Gaza, their rudimentary shelter is not suitable accommodation for humans, but they have nowhere else to go. There are so many others in a similar situation. About 1.3 million people, more than half of all Gaza's inhabitants, are crammed into Rafah following mass displacement. The Hanuns were forced to leave their home in Sheikh Radwan neighborhood of Gaza City. The Zionist regime has repeatedly bombarded the area during the current genocidal war. The farm where they are now living does not have a bathroom. To use one, they visit Al-Hilal Al-Emirati, a maternity hospital in Rafah. The family have arranged showers among the farm's battery cages. They have boiled water on a wood fire before showering. Ahmad Hanun said, we have to strip off in front of each other. There is no privacy during the war. The farm where they live smells terribly and they constantly have to contend with insects. The children have experienced diarrhea. Loy, a 7-year-old boy, has been diagnosed with hepatitis A. His health is in a very serious condition. When it rains heavily, the area where they live has been flooded by sewage, destroying blankets, mattresses, and even food. The family's only protection during wet weather is to stay inside the cages. Ahmad Hanun said, "I find it unbelievable that we live in such filth. This is a place for animals and birds, not people. We had anticipated staying here for a few days until we found somewhere more suitable, but we haven't managed to find anywhere else." Adel Jom'e had to flee his home in Jabalia refugee camp, northern Gaza, a few months ago. First, he and his family went to Khan Yunis in the south. Later, they moved to Rafah. After seeking an apartment in Rafah, they realized that they could not afford the high rents being charged. They ended up assembling a tent on the grounds of a zoo owned by a relative. That means they have to live beside animals who are starving. A number of the lions in the zoo have already died since the war began. With food scarce, the zoo's owner is trying to keep the remaining lions alive with bread. The lions had previously eaten chicken. The zoo animal's weight has fallen drastically. The bathroom in the zoo is located close to the animal's cages. Adele's 7-year-old son, Rami, is terrified of going to the bathroom after dark. The boy started experiencing severe pains recently. When he was brought to hospital, he was diagnosed with kidney stones and required surgery. The doctor told the family that such problems can occur if children try to avoid urinating. Rami has trouble sleeping as he is afraid of the lions. He has asked his parents repeatedly if the animals can escape from the cages and attack humans. Sarah, his mother, replied that animals pose no risk to people who feed and care for them. Sarah said, "Rami is always asking when he can leave this horrific place and go back to our old home. I don't know how to answer him. I am lost for words." Yasser Helles and his family are now living in a greenhouse near Rafah's seashore. Given that the Zionist regime's naval forces are firing toward Rafah, the area is anything but safe. The family had to take shelter there as tents in short supply and the few available ones costly. Yasser said, "It takes weeks just for a charity to give you one. There are so many people on the list for tents, so we were forced to take shelter here, which is not a suitable place to live." Ahmad Yasser's 15-year-old son recently went to a local school and queued for hours before he could find water. Once his container was filled, he used a wheelchair to transport it. Yet the wheelchair fell over and water spilled. On his way back to his family, Ahmad was distraught. Since they have taken shelter in the greenhouse, the extended family have been sleeping on mattresses. Yasser's 72-year-old mother has experienced backache. Yasser said, "I often could not find painkillers for her in pharmacies or in UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees clinics. She cannot bear the agony."
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. علم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
پیغمبر اکرم نمونه.
The holy prophet of Islam is the example
of عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant fact.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
امامت is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Very welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
چشم خدا با این دیدن خودش بزرگ میشه آدم.
Recognizing Allah's blessings and seeing them make us great in the eyes of Allah. The late Muhaddis al-Qumi in his book Safina al-Bahar narrates a beautiful hadith stating, Prophet Moses asked Allah to be shown the best of the worshippers of his time. An address was given to Moses. He went there and found a sick, crippled, leper man. Prophet Moses at first thought he went to a wrong address, but he was told that you are on the right address. Moses thought to himself that he will find a person in constant glorification of God in prayer and not a crippled man.
جبرئیل نازل شد گفت یا موسی درست اومدی آدرس همینه و الان من مأمورم.
Gabriel came down to Moses and confirmed the address and told Moses that he is on a mission to take away the eyesight of the crippled man too. As soon as the crippled man lost his eyesight, he raised his head to the sky and said, O God, you bestowed me many blessings. Upon hearing this, Prophet Moses went forward and said, I am Prophet of God. Ask me if you need anything. The crippled man responded, Thanks, but I am satisfied with what Allah gave me. Moses, in order to test the man, said, What did Allah give you, since you are a crippled leper who is sick? The man replied, Allah has given me the power to recognize His blessings in the whole region, and this is the best blessing of Allah upon me. This story shows that seeing the blessings of Allah and thanking Him for what He bestows upon us is itself a blessing. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Amazon.
Part 2.
In this situation, it is natural that no publisher can compete with Amazon. Even other big competitors cannot win in this situation. Even the world's technology giant, Apple, fails as well. In 2010, Amazon had 95% of the audiobook market share, and Apple wanted to be part of the deal. Apple executives arranged meetings with five major publishers and suggested that the pricing iBook be done by the publishers and 30% of the profit would go to Apple. Meanwhile, Bezos announced that the price of audiobooks would be reduced to 99 cents. A few weeks after the decision of the publishers and Apple, Amazon filed complaints against these companies in the Federal Trade Commission. In the spring of 2012, the U.S. Court of Justice found Apple and five publishers guilty of conspiring to raise prices and prevent competition. Finally, all publishers negotiated and agreed with the government.
Amazon's battle with Hachette and the authors that Hachette publishes is heating up.
Macmillan and Penguin had to pay $20 million and $75 million respectively. It was a large amount of money that was difficult to pay in a business that always suffered from a lack of profit. Apple appealed the Supreme Court ruling. In the summer of the same year, the judge ruled in favor of the government and, in fact, Amazon. Apple was sentenced to pay $845 million in damages because the company had violated antitrust laws, according to the government. In fact, the government believed that Amazon operated completely based on the free market and competition rules. However, at the end of the day, Amazon monopolized the audiobook market. After this decision, many people talked about Bezos's secret relationship with American judges and, of course, the government. Exactly 3 weeks after winning the court case against Apple, Barack Obama visited an Amazon warehouse in the Chattanooga area where workers were paid an average of $11 an hour. He praised the creation of decent employment by Amazon.
It's great to be here at Amazon!
Everything was coordinated to benefit Bezos the most.
Last year, during the busiest day of the Christmas rush, customers around the world ordered more than 300 items from Amazon every second.
Reducing prices is the biggest service that Amazon has provided to its customers. However, it was possible to reduce the prices and the cost until a certain time. From then on, he had to play the game based on his own rules. Amazon warehouses are built in cities with the highest unemployment rates, with the lowest wages for workers. In recent years, Amazon has contributed a lot to the employment of Americans and has hired 30,000 people a year. Workers who enter these warehouses do not have the right to be members of any union. According to eyewitnesses, they work in strange conditions.
You have
security cameras right behind you at all times that are looking at you 24/7. And if you don't meet standards or the rates, you're out the door. You're just disposable.
Every worker has a scanner at all times that basically track exactly where you're at.
And they have a little blue line at the bottom of the screen, and it has like how many seconds that you have to have it done by the time it hits zero. And it puts you into panic mode.
And pretty much you can't talk to people. You can't be in the same aisle as them. You just constantly have to sit there scanning like a robot all day long. If they catch you not scanning, you get a write-up.
And what they're doing is they're producing this massive data that they are using to be able to analyze the entire workforce.
Each worker in this department walks about 11 miles per shift, considering such restrictions. The worker has only 33 seconds in order to pack a product. In the US, they hired 47 people for this type of jobs for every $10 million in revenue. This figure for Amazon is 14 people for every $10 million. This situation reminds everyone of Modern Times, directed by Charlie Chaplin. Everyone has only one task to do in these warehouses, and there is no such thing as creativity. Bezos also eliminates publishers to reduce the costs. Amazon has been publishing books for many years. If you want your books to be published in audio format, you will receive up to 70% of the revenue. This figure is about 15% in the printed books of other publishers. Publishers are worried about Amazon's policy because right now, it is Amazon that has control over everything and has created a kind of monopoly in book industry. When customers and publishers are satisfied, there is no one left to claim anything. The U.S. government also supports Amazon and the U.S. citizens. All 130 companies of the Amazon group are active in the fashion industry, chain supermarkets, bag and shoe sales, podcast production, cloud storage, books, photography, data analysis, cinema, and several other areas. It is a huge organization in which everything exists, and that is indicated in the Amazon logo. There is a yellow arrow that goes from A to Z. It means that there is everything in Amazon, but Jeff Bezos thinks that you can't find everything in Amazon, but Amazon in everything itself. When you check IMDb site, when you purchase from Whole Food Market, when you buy shoes from Zappos, when you buy groceries from Amazon Fresh, when you buy clothes from ShopBop, when you use AWS and check all sites to buy online products, you're actually active in Amazon and help Jeff Bezos get richer. When you watch a movie on Netflix, you're actually helping Bezos, because Netflix uses AWS. That is why Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world.
Breaking news tonight, a stunner from the richest man in the world.
Bezos knows people's interests because he's well aware of their taste in choosing books. In fact, Bezos was one of the first people to understand that information was the most valuable thing in cyberspace and the internet. Many experts believe that Selling books was just a way for Bezos to collect information from people. Bezos now owns the information of millions of people around the world and has managed to launch Amazon's warehouses. Amazon warehouses store products that the customer does not know about. But Amazon predicts that people will need these products in the near future and stores them in warehouses near customers' houses.
He was part of the online revolution that put the future of printed word up in the air. Can he help save it? Within the last few minutes, CNN has learned that Jeff Bezos, the founder and CEO of Amazon.com, is buying the Washington Post.
In 2015, Jeff Bezos bought Washington Post for $250 million. It was strange because Bezos was not interested in paper and printing, but he bought the Washington Post company's newspaper publishing business. When he first visited the Washington Post, he clearly manifested his feelings. He asked the managers to look for a tablet for reading a newspaper. In fact, Bezos became more powerful by buying the Washington Post. Now he is a man with a lot of money, media, and a lot of information. He only needs weapons to create a self-governing government.
This deal could give him more influence over politics.
Nobody hangs out in Washington, D.C. just to go to the free museums. You buy a home in Washington, you buy a newspaper in Washington because it is the most influential city in the world, and you want to lay your hands on that power.
It is not possible for many people in the world to live without Amazon. This company has become so big that others have to adapt themselves to it. It is just like the Amazon River, because there is life next to it. But if there is a fluvial, people will lose their lives for sure. People's lives are affected by any small change in Amazon. Companies that prefer to be a part of Amazon instead of confronting it are best described in a sentence in A Flag of Sunrise book by Robert Stone. Sometimes the mouse is so afraid that it endangers itself and goes to the cat itself. It seems that the cat and mouse game has entered a new era.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how can we change that bad habit of ours? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here at your service. Dear listeners, we are talking about how can we just get rid of that bad habit of ours when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. Now, there's a couple of things that we need to take into consideration when we are talking about a bad habit. So first and foremost, you know, there are certain bad habits which are, you know, they're not really religiously considered to be bad habits. I don't know, they're just kind of these things that we have, you know, we've become accustomed to doing over the years, but there are certain bad habits which are religiously considered to be bad habits. So, for example, you know, I don't know, you know, lying or backbiting or cheating or stealing. I don't know. These are things that are very apparently and very overtly they're bad habits. God forbid that they don't become habits, but they are bad habits that are religiously, you know, prohibited bad habits. But, you know, some things are not religiously prohibited bad habits. I mean, so, I don't know, for example, you have a, I guess it could be considered a bad habit, you know, that you like to put your fork on the right side of your plate or something like that. I don't know, the things that are not religiously prohibited. Now, we're talking about primarily those habits which are religiously prohibited. You know, these kind of negative qualities that appear, you know, in a human being, and how to fix that. So that is primarily what we're talking about on this session. Now, how do we get rid of these bad habits? Well, we already talked about the first aspect and the first step, which is to be able to identify, you know, what bad habit we're talking about and what bad habit, you know, we need to fix within ourselves. So the first step, of course, is to be able to identify what it is that we are doing, you know, which is a religiously prohibited bad habit, so that slowly but surely we can work on that and hopefully be able to get rid of that pesky little bad habit. Welcome back. This is A2Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about how to get rid of that Islamically prohibited bad habit so that we can achieve that ultimate Islamic lifestyle. Now, of course, you know, this takes time. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of practice, you know. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes we grow up and we pick up these bad habits. And as we said, religiously prohibited bad habits over the years. And then, you know, when we become relative adults and we grow up, if you will, we realize that these habits have become a part of us, and they become, well, much more difficult to be able to handle and to be able to remove from ourselves. And this here is something that's really important for any parent out there, is to make sure that you get rid of these bad habits in your children before they grow up and before these things become a habit. And especially those habits which are religiously prohibited. And this is one of the perhaps one of the greatest responsibilities of a parent, and that is to be able to help to control certain religiously prohibited bad habits that might, you know, become habits for their children. So anyways, it takes a lot of time. Of course, we said that the first step is to be able to identify that this is a bad habit, and then you kind of make a plan of action in order to prevent yourself from falling into that bad habit, in order to protect yourself from being in a situation where you are, you know, kind of forced to fall into that bad habit. And make sure that, you know, you remove yourself from any kind of situations that will push you towards that bad habit, whether it's lying or stealing or whatever it may be. You have to identify. And then it's a relatively long process. You know, don't think that it's going to be, you know, overnight you're going to be able to fix all of your bad habits. No, it takes time. It takes perseverance. It takes determination. You know, and some of these spiritual wayfaring masters, they have said that it has taken them a whole lifetime to be able to control something. And there are some who have said that despite being able to control a certain bad habit, for their whole lifetime, they are still afraid and they are still very careful because they might fall into the same trap. But nonetheless, the fact that you are trying to remove that bad habit is something which is commendable, and it will eventually, inshallah, by the grace and the blessings of Allah, it will help you to attain that Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
It's April 17, 1917. British forces launched their invasion to capture Palestine, still part of the Ottoman Empire. The battle goes on for 3 days. The casualties on the British side are mounting. They have to retreat. London then recruits Arab tribes, promising to help them shake off the yoke of the Ottomans. With their assistance, the British raid and destroy Ottoman supply lines and logistics in the Palestine region. On the first day of November 1917, the British forces mount a new round of invasion on Gaza. Lack of ammunition and supply cripple Ottoman defense line. Gaza falls into the hands of the British, and by December 1917, they take Al-Quds, but never honor their promise. Instead, the British occupy Palestine until 1948, when they hand over the Holy Land to the Jews flooding in from across the world. The Palestinian plight and the struggle for liberation begins. On May 14, 1948, General Alan Cunningham, the last British High Commissioner, left what was known then as the Mandate of Palestine. John Marlowe wrote of the last few minutes of British rule in his book, The Seat of Pilate. The Union Jack was lowered, and with the speed of an execution and the silence of a ship that passes in the night, British rule in Palestine came to an end. On the same day, David Ben-Gurion announced the establishment of Israel. It came as a shock to the Arab world. Several Arab countries joined forces to expel the insolent newcomers, but faced a crushing defeat. A neo-colonial project, Israel systematically took over Palestinian lands, expelling people from their homes, and leaving many to live as refugees in isolated enclaves. Official records conservatively estimate that back then, at least 750,000 Palestinians were forcibly removed from their homes and lands by Israeli forces, resulting in the capture of 78% of historic Palestine. The remaining 22% was divided into the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. the displaced Palestinians entered a state of diaspora, with many spending the rest of their lives in refugee camps. In addition to the conquest of major cities, approximately 530 Palestinian villages were destroyed, and around 15,000 Palestinians lost their lives in a series of large-scale atrocities. Crushed and crestfallen, the Arabs vowed to wreak revenge, take their stolen lands back, and restore their lost pride, honor, and glory. With the rise of pan-Arabic Gamal Abdel Nasser, hope and enthusiasm came back among the Arabs. A coalition of Arab states was formed to go to war with Israel on June 5, 1967. This time around, Israel overwhelmed the coalition in less than a week. The decisive victory included the capture of the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, the old city of Al-Quds, and the Golan Heights. The Arab countries' losses in the conflict were disastrous. Egypt's casualties numbered more than 11,000, with 6,000 for Jordan and 1,000 for Syria, compared with only 700 for Israel. The Arab armies also suffered crippling losses of weaponry and equipment. The Six-Day War also created hundreds of thousands of refugees and brought more than 1 million Palestinians in the occupied territories under Israeli rule. The defeat demoralized both the Arab public and the political elite. Pan-Arabism was defanged, and hopes to take back Palestine were shattered. The Palestinian issue remained unresolved as an Arab problem. Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir famously claimed in an interview with the Sunday Times on June 15, 1969, that there were no such things as Palestinians. They didn't exist. Almost a decade later, in 1978, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin signed the Camp David Accords, according to which Egypt would recognize Israel as a legitimate state. A stab in the back of Palestine. Betrayed by Egypt and abandoned by the rest of the Arab world, the Palestinian nation was withering away under the illegal, brutal occupation. Two countries away from Palestine, the Iranian people were making history by toppling the powerful regime of Mohammad Reza Shah, who, like the Israelis, had the United States on his side. The fall of the Shah, who had the biggest army in the Middle East and the fifth greatest one in the world, rekindled hopes in the hearts of the Palestinians. The invincible could be vincible. In the words of the co-founder of Hamas, Abdelaziz Al-Rantisi, "We believe that the Islamic Revolution of Iran has had a positive impact on other Muslim countries. It has awakened them, and I believe this awakening accounts for uprisings across the Muslim world." The newly established Islamic Republic was, however, more than a role model for the Palestinian nation. Iran ended its alliance with Israel overnight in favor of the Palestinians. Just 6 days after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the Palestine Liberation Organization chief Yasser Arafat led a 58-member delegation to Tehran. As the first official foreign politician to visit Iran, Arafat was warmly received by thousands of Iranians chanting in support of Palestine. When someone goes to their home, they do not need permission, Arafat told the public during his visit to Tehran. He declared, "Iran's revolution is a great victory for Palestine. When I entered Iran's airspace, I felt like I entered the airspace of Beit al-Muqaddas." Tehran turned the Israeli embassy to the Palestinian embassy and renamed the road in front of it to Palestine Street, an act of symbolic importance. At the same time, founder of the Islamic Revolution, Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Khomeini, designated the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as Quds Day, calling on all Muslims across the world to mark the day annually in solidarity with the downtrodden people of Palestine. It was a message to the whole world. Palestine is not just an Arab problem. With this spiritual assistance from the charismatic leader of the revolution, Palestine was saved from oblivion. The Palestinian plight came to the foreground, a new lease of life for Palestinian fighters to keep on their uphill battle against the occupiers. The two major Palestinian resistance groups, i.e. the Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, PIJ, and Hamas, officially announced their existence in the 1980s. As an underground movement, Islamic Jihad had been found in the late 1970s by Fathi Shaghari, a young physician and a Gaza refugee. Endorsing the Islamic Revolution of Iran, Shaghari said, "This revolution was a wake-up call to us all that our victory is contingent upon following Imam Khomeini's path. So it behooves us to avoid all other ways except the way shown by the Imam in our fight against the occupation regime of Israel." Tehran's ties with the Palestinian resistance groups developed steadily, even when the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein waged one of the bloodiest and longest wars in the region against Iran. Iran's closer cooperation with the Palestinian groups began in 1987 after Israel expelled Hamas and Islamic Jihad leaders to Lebanon as part of its efforts to suppress the Palestinian national leadership in the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. The raging war against Iran failed to distract the nation from the Palestinian cause. The Islamic Republic expressed its deep disagreements over the so-called Reagan peace plan and the Fahd peace plan, where the rights of the Palestinians had been almost totally ignored in favor of the Israeli regime. Inspired partly by the Islamic Revolution, in December 1987, the Palestinian people staged a sustained series of protests, civil disobedience, and riots, which later came to be known as the First Intifada, or the Stone Intifada, as they were still throwing stones at Israeli soldiers who were armed to the teeth. Amid the deafening silence of Arab leaders, Tehran lent all its support to the Palestinian cause. Imam Khomeini took a clear, strong stance, saying with the Israeli regime in place, the Palestinians would not see the end of their sufferings. In 1993, Fathi Shaghari told Newsday, "Iran gives us money and supports us. Then we supply the money and arms to the occupied territories and support the families of our people." To draw further attention to the pain and suffering of the Palestinian people, a couple of years after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iranian pilgrims began staging demonstrations against Israel and its major supporter, the United States, at the Hajj. Perhaps one thing that sparked the flames of the First Intifada was a tragic incident that happened that year in Mecca, Saudi Arabia. On July 31, 1987, during one of these pro-Palestinian demonstrations, the clash between Iranian demonstrators and Saudi security forces turned bloody, resulting in the deaths of more than 400 pilgrims. Hamas, an acronym in Arabic for Islamic Resistance Movement, emerged out of the First Palestinian Intifada in 1987. It was co-founded by Sheikh Ahmed Yassin and six others, originally as a local offshoot of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood. On May 2, 1998, Hamas, still a fledgling group with less than a decade since its formation, paid a visit to Tehran to meet the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The meeting happened when almost none of the leaders of the Arab world took the Palestinian Intifada seriously. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, however, had a different opinion about the struggle, the group, and its leader, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. Iran pledged financial support and provided the group with advanced military training at bases belonging to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps in Iran and Lebanon. It also trained Palestinian engineers to manufacture weapons locally. The Second Palestinian Intifada erupted in September 2000, after the collapse of the so-called Middle East peace talks at Camp David and Ariel Sharon's unlawful visit to Haram al-Sharif, the home of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. It was a major uprising by the Palestinians against the Israeli occupation that continued for 5 years. In 2006, Hamas won a huge majority in parliamentary elections, with Palestinian voters giving the group 76 seats in parliament out of the 132 seats available. After the Hamas victory, Khalid Mash'al visited Tehran and said, "Just as Islamic Iran defends the rights of the Palestinians, we defend the rights of Islamic Iran. We are part of a united front against the enemies of Islam." Unlike some other Palestinian groups, Hamas never recognized the occupation regime. So following the group's takeover of Gaza, a crippling blockade was imposed on the Strip to limit the movement of the people and goods, a collective punishment for electing an uncompromising group. To put more pressure, the US and its allies imposed sanctions on Hamas and the community the group represented. Many in the Arab world left the group high and dry, but the Islamic Republic, an all-weather friend, never withdrew its support for the group in the hardest of times. The Shia state gave a hand to the Sunni group to remind the Muslim world that Palestine transcends sectarian differences. On March 9, 2008, a Hamas senior commander, interviewed by the Sunday Times, said 300 of the group's best brains had been secretly sent to Tehran. According to the commander, who wished to remain anonymous, half are still being trained by the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. They're learning how to make explosives from everyday items and produce more effective rockets. The rest have already returned from the IRGC base in Tehran. Some have been trained as snipers. Others have learned to use tunnels in attacks on Israeli forces. Iran is our mother. She gives us information, military supplies, and financial support. The resistance movement in Palestine built up steam when Lieutenant General Haj Qasem Soleimani took the helm of Iran's Quds Force, one of the IRGC's branches with its main focus on assisting resistance groups in the region. Thanks to Tehran's unwavering support, resistance groups in Palestine grew strong enough to deal the hardest blows on the Israeli regime. Something unimaginable after the Six-Day War. For the Palestinians, time for lopsided defeat had gone, and for the Israelis, victory was no longer for granted. Subsequent wars like the one in 2012 left no doubt that the Palestinians had risen from the ashes. During a visit by Hamas leaders to Iran in 2019, Ayatollah Khamenei stated, "Not many years ago, the Palestinians fought against Israel with stones. But today, instead of stones, they're equipped with precision missiles. This signifies development." Struggle against the occupation regime reached its crescendo in October 7, 2023, when Hamas forces launched a land, air, and sea attack into the heart of the Israeli occupation territories, catching the enemy off guard and shattering its myth of invincibility in spite of all its state-of-the-art weapons and its huge military expenditure. Iran was not involved in the attack, but who can deny the country's decades-long support that molded drone flyers out of the stone-throwing fighters?
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.